They're coming to get you, Barbara.
I don't know what you come to do, but I come to praise name.
Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing.
What is good, y'all? Welcome to Hushaya. It's your boy. I am your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today, film reviews editor at The Rep, my man, Alonzo Duralde. What is good with you, sir?
Saltines and milk.
Coming in with the health. Yes, sir. Ooh.
I have just discovered, it's not even like this is a comfort thing from my childhood, but in adulthood, I have realized saltines and a glass of milk, they're a great combination.
Is that right?
Just saltines, but yeah.
Look, vegan, I don't want to hear about my dairy intake.
Milk is just gross. When
they ask you what's good, April, you can talk about your lactose intolerance. Saltines and milk.
Saltines
are awesome.
And milk. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And the voice you heard right there, who despises milk, don't want to hear nothing about it.
Even when I was still eating like dairy, I was just like, ugh. What is up with this milk? It's gross.
No disrespect.
You're a terrible Midwesterner.
That's true.
Milk is funky. Milk is not good.
Milk is awesome.
I would have visions, dreams as a fat child of having just like the container.
Is this just a Dr. King speech? I'm sorry. I started away before I called my name.
No, please do. I had a dream of like just having the strawberry Nestle Quick container, the powder, and just pouring the gallon of milk into that, stirring that. And then just chugging that like a fucking champion, yo.
That's not milk, though. That's just like sugar water.
Yes.
See, and your point would be?
Yeah, exactly. Now you're talking to a Cuban Colombian, yo. Sugar water. We call that coffee. That is film critic, host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, April Wolf. April, what is good with you?
Just a couple quick things. I read an article on Wired that just blew me away, and everyone should totally read it. It's about these two people. The woman of the couple got diagnosed with this terminal illness that was just like definitely going to kill her, and it was like a genetic thing. And then even though they were like, you know, in their 30s or something, they both quit their jobs, became scientists, and are now trying to find a cure for it.
Oh, damn.
Lorenzo's Oil.
The story is phenomenal. It's just like, you have to read the story. It's so well written. But also the Criterion announced today that my essay for the release of A Face in a Crowd.
Woo! So that's what I'm talking about.
So I'm excited because that's going to come out in March.
April.
The release. Is it April?
Yeah. In April.
It's in April, yeah.
April.
Yes. Sometimes it's April in April, yo. Yes.
So that's, and everyone should just be watching A Face in the Crowd anyway, because it's a fantastic fucking movie, and the restoration of it, it's, everything is just so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
A Face in the Crowd is amazing. That's so awesome.
Yeah, hell yeah. I work with the dopest people, y'all. That's what's up. That's what's up. Oh, our special guest today, you might not know this, though, but we did shows in Chicago at Zany's. Back in the day, yes, sir.
Wow.
You and Doug Benson and I.
Oh my God!
Yes, sir.
That's a million years ago.
It's been a minute. He's a comedian. He's a host of the Comedy Film Nerds podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Graham Elwood is in the building.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for being
here.
I feel it's my duty to weigh in on this milk argument.
Please do.
That we're having.
Please do say that shit.
So I was born in Wisconsin, grew up drinking the glasses of milk and all that. But since I've been living in California, now I've become, of course, weirdo vegan Californian.
Drink almond milk?
I do drink almond milk.
Pea
and here's
milk.
The thing I will say to people that go to this might not win me any points at the top of the show, but to the milk drinkers, do whatever makes you feel comfortable. Just picture this, a chimpanzee nursing a cow. And then tell me if you think that seems normal to you, because that is how weird it is for humans to drink cow's milk.
It's weird.
It's weird.
It's weird.
It's weird.
It freaks me out.
It's delicious.
I'm just like, I'm waiting for Alonzo to go straight to the source and we'll get a picture of him just like spraying like a teat straight into his mouth.
I would. If I lived on a dairy farm, I would be not, I would cut out the middleman.
I hear a Kickstarter.
The name of your GoFundMe is? Go ahead, Alonzo.
Cow Buddies. Wait, Graham, what's good?
Oh, movie-wise?
Anything
that's good.
Spiritually, emotionally.
Anything that's good, surfing.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm a surfer, and I haven't been able to because it's been cold and rainy, so I just am thinking about it constantly. I'm thinking about the last wave I rode about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. It's been 2 weeks.
Well, you really left Wisconsin.
I remember, telling my brother, I don't know, his birthday, 10, 15 years ago, I'd already become a vegetarian, and I, started surfing, and he just went, up, oh, here we go. He's just back in Chicago, all right, California. I do yoga. I'm the worst.
Land of fruits and nuts.
Yeah, exactly. It was just what else? You got your Reiki healer hat on. What else you got going on there, friend?
How's your chakra?
Yeah, you got your chakras all lined up there, Buttercup. All right.
Ricky, what's good?
Oh, thank you, April.
He let me have it.
He did. What's good with me is I want to double back to last week's episode real quick if I can, because last week we talked about If Beale Street Could Talk, and everybody on the panel was in favor of the movie, and I kind of was in favor of the movie, but I didn't.
You were stream it.
I was a stream it fan. I was in the stream it category, but I wasn't able to give a shout out to what was my favorite thing about the movie, which was the score by Nicholas Britell, which I am still listening to. Everybody out there, listen to the score from If Beale Street Could Talk. It is so goddamn great. It's very similar to in the vein of the score to Moonlight. After I listened to the score after I watched the movie, obviously, but the first song on the score is called Eden. And it immediately took me back to the first shot in the movie, which is when our couple that we're introduced to is literally walking through what looks like through this Garden of Eden. And it's just this great shot. And the song that's playing is fantastic. If Beale Street Could Talk, the score, yo, it's got bangers. Bump that shit at the crib.
He won best score at LA Film Critics. And at the dinner this weekend, he said that his wife is the cellist.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so they collaborated on everything.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. On this episode, we'll be talking about Karen Kusama's Destroyer. We will be talking about movies that we've changed our minds on in a segment we are calling Film Floppers. And as always, we will have our staff picks at the end of the show. But let's just get right into It a Dick, which is short for Is This Important? Do I Care? How it works is I will read a news. All of us are going to read.
I thought you just said eat a dick. Okay.
It's a little play on words, bro. Right. It's a little play on words. I mean, is that what you heard?
Did you just tell me to blow 10 guys? Is that what I heard? Do you always say that to the guests?
If we can open up the door and let the 10 gentlemen in, please.
Here's Graham's GoFundMe.
How it works is we are all going to read a news headline and people can jump in by answering these two questions. Is this important? Do I care? I am going to go first because the first news story that we have this week, ladies and gentlemen, it is happening. The sequel to the greatest comedy ever put on film is reportedly on the way. Deadline is reporting that a sequel to Coming to America is on the way. Coming to America, starring Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, Sherry Hadley, John Amos, and James Earl Jones. Reportedly, all of them are coming back. Eddie has said that he's coming back. It's going to be directed by Craig Brewer, who directed Hustle and Flow, Black Snake Moan. His most recent movie is Dolomite Is My Name, which is going to be a Netflix release starring Eddie Murphy. The sequel is going to follow Eddie's character, Prince Hakeem. He's coming back to America to find his long-lost son, who will be the heir to the throne of Zamunda. There is no release date yet. Is this important? Do you all care?
I mean, Coming to America is one of the funniest movies. I could quote it all day, all night.
You know what I mean? Would.
Boys, mama call him Clay. I'm going to call him Clay. I could do that all day, night.
Sex
with chocolate. Yeah, those boys are good. The one character's always eating. I mean, just like he played Joe the Policeman on the What's Going Down episode of That's My Mama. Like, I could do that. I could do it. So my first instinct is yes, more. And doing a sequel this far down the road as for a comedy is a good sign. It's not just a money grab that they do 18 months later. But man, it is so hard to find a comedy sequel that is as funny as the first. Mm. It is I mean, it is hard to find. Some of the
Problem
worst.
Child 2, though?
22 Jump Street.
Yeah.
Wow. Problem child, too low. Come on now.
It's hard to find. And
it
some,
really is.
Some of the worst movies ever made are sequels. Like
too
Caddyshack
yeah.
2
Oof.
Is
unwatchable.
Blues Brothers 2000. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's my fear.
Also,
yes.
Is Craig Brewer funny?
I don't know if he is. I mean, I'm very much looking forward to this Dolomite Is My Name movie, but mm-hmm. when I think of Craig Brewer, I think of Hustle and Flow.
Yeah.
I don't think of
Black
comedies.
Snake.
But I think Black Snake Moan has enough kind of wry humor to it in a way that you think that he could direct it. Kenya mm-hmm. Barris is the one who's rewriting the script mm-hmm. from Blackish, and, you know, Blackish is a really sharp comedy that's, you know, got its finger on the pulse, so to say, mm-hmm. so to speak, of you know, contemporary like youth and
also
and stuff right now.
Craig
so.
Brewer fundamentally understand Africa the way John Landis does.
Oh my God!
That's the big question. Although this whole plot, though, so now Eddie Murphy's character, despite pining for this one woman in the whole film and their whole beautifully pure relationship, now we found out that he like has some.
Baby daddy issues.
Baby daddy
maybe.
Issues. Going on? Yeah, what is that about?
Yeah, yeah. There's it. The plot of it definitely makes me ask questions. But like you were saying, Graham, I mean, there's when a comedy comes out very quickly after a sequel comes out very quickly after a comedy, I'm like, but this much time has passed, and somebody like Kenya Barris is involved. Somebody like Craig Brewer is involved. Like Eddie is surrounding himself. It seems like with. The right people at the moment.
I feel like that's a good point because when you rush the comedy, then you're just like, it feels like they rehash the same jokes and stuff like that. Whereas this, if they really sit down and go, all right, whatever it's been, 25, 30 years, 20 years, whatever, what would the funniest version of this character's history? What happened to McDougal's? And if they really sit there and
McDowell's.
McDowell's,
yes.
Right. We call it the Big Mick.
What's the last Eddie Murphy movie? Was it Norbit?
No. Dare you? How dare you?
I did see Norbit in the theaters.
What was it? I mean, I honestly don't remember.
Man, I want to say Tower Heist, but I know that's wrong.
No,
is Mr. Church. Was it Mr. Church?
Oh, God, Mr. Church.
I know, and I heard that was bad.
He's okay, not counting Dreamgirls, what's the last good Eddie Murphy movie?
Man.
Wow.
I don't know if Eddie Murphy could even name that. I mean, he's like probably, I don't know.
Yeah, he has it. Well, what I love about it is he's admitted like, yeah, I've made movies for money.
All right.
You know,
my enthusiasm is tempered by the fact that I had to sit through 1,000 words or whatever that movie was
Holy
called.
Holy man.
Yeah.
There's
Holy
a list.
Holy man.
Yeah. Pluto you know, Nash.
Meet Dave. Just saying.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I hear you to do that.
Okay, so if you haven't seen Netflix's Bird Box with Sandra Bullock, you're one of the few. Cardi B recently watched the film herself, and she has some questions and theories of her own. We have a clip here, but a quick warning, there is some bad language.
Horrors? Fetch my smelling salts.
Guys, so I'm finally watching this movie. Don't fucking judge me. Suck my dick. I'm not a person to watch movies a lot. I need questions because I feel like I'm getting lost now. You know what I'm saying? Like, what are they seeing, bro? Like, what's making them want to kill themselves? Like, what is it? Are they seeing some spirit? Like, are they seeing what's making them want to kill themselves, bro? I don't fucking get it. Shit's getting me mad. Are they fucking seeing their bills? I think motherfuckers are seeing their bills. That's why they want to fucking kill themselves. All right, bitch. Now I'm mad again. Because why are these motherfuckers walking around with some birds and some bird cages? What did I miss what these birds doing?
Yep. That was the same thing my mom said after she watched the movie.
Okay.
Oh, Cardi, never change.
So, is this important? Do you care?
I'm sure she's not alone with these questions, but, you know, I think the movie does pretty much explain what it needs to explain. What people see, they're never specific about, but I think you get the impression that it's attuned to you specifically, which is why, like, Sandra Bullock hears voices of people that, you know, were close to her who are dead, and, you know, the birds, we're told, are an early warning system, so...
I mean, for me, this is basically what she said is word for word my review on Comedy Film Nerds. That's basically in the same cadence.
And it's like, fucking suck my dick.
Bro?
I like how like the script has me saying, but a quick warning, there's some bad language. Like, I'm the one.
That blue nose April. So prim.
I'm surprised that this is the movie that Netflix is now kind of starting to be like, hey, here's how many people are watching this thing. Netflix used to be so hush-hush about what their numbers are.
They'll do it occasionally. I think they did some first-week numbers for that Kurt Russell Santa movie.
Okay.
But maybe they're really leaning into this one. And a friend of mine pointed out that they kind of released it at the perfect time, like sort of between Christmas and New Year's, or people don't want to leave the house. So like that's when it became this phenomenon. You know, like, mm-hmm. yes, Christmas is a big time for big movies to open at the theater, and obviously people do go to the movies. But for the most part, you just want to kind of like spend that week kicking it. And so it was like, hey, it's on Netflix. Oh, Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. Did people here watch Bird Box?
No. I did.
Did you? What did you think, Graham?
I actually liked it. I was able to suspend my disbelief for it. You know, we were talking about it on Comedy Film Nerds, and my co-host and our guest both didn't buy it. They had too many questions like that are unanswered. Like, mm-hmm. they kind of introduced some rules of these ghosts or demons or whatever, and we don't quite know what they are. I just was like, I'm on board, whatever. Like, this is cool, and it was just sort of her personal journey, and I like the flashbacks, and I don't know if you guys do spoilers on this show, but I like...
You can do one. As long as you say the word spoilers first.
Okay,
like
spoiler alert. Yeah. The ending where they go to the blind school, I thought that was really cool. But all of the questions... It was one of those things where, like, I almost changed my mind when I heard, like, other people on our show, like, well, I have the problem with this and this and this and this and this. I was like, that's a valid point. I just got in and watched it and was like, all right, you know, crazy demon, zombie, witch, ghosts, whatever. I don't know what they're doing. Yeah. They're alien. I don't care.
I thought it worked, and I liked the way that they kind of tell the story through flashbacks so that it regulates when you find out certain pieces of information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interestingly put together. And there's Lil Rel Howery's in it, and he has a joke about how he's writing an apocalyptic novel, but it's not about, like, kids with crossbows. And I did like seeing an end-of-the-world movie that was not about, like, plucky tweens, but that was about adults.
Sure.
I've been so critical. Netflix movies are so not really – they're not great.
They're not, yeah.
Their scripted episodic stuff is fantastic. Like, their scripted episodic is like Marvel movies, and then their feature films are like DC. Like, it's really it's.
Hey, they gave us Roma and Buster Scruggs this year, and Happy as Lazaro. That's good. That carries a lot of weight.
Well, hold on.
No, I also,
Roma
I really...
is not Netflix. Did not create Roma. I mean, like Netflix yes. movies. That's they true. Got Kirayan. They said you do whatever you want. But a lot of these movies that they make, or they either make them, or I feel like. They go to festivals
they acquire them,
and they acquire them. No one else would buy them, so they just buy them because they just need content. But a lot of the Netflix movies are like...
Well, the ones that they acquire at film festivals are usually fucking pretty good. Private Life, The Kindergarten Teacher, that's great. They financed Like Father that came out this year, too, and that was a surprise.
Did they finance like a Private hit. Life, or did they acquire
they
it?
They acquired it out of the festival. What Same about, thing, Kindergarten Teacher.
What about Land of Steady Habits?
Land of Steady Habits, they may have financed it, and they had a deal with Cam when Cam was made for streaming. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they knew that they were going to be, that they had a deal with Netflix and that Netflix financed it, or, you know, it was picked up in... I'm not really sure, but I know that Cam was made to be on Netflix.
Look, Bright was a piece of shit. I agree.
There's also Extinction is not great.
Extinction is not great at all.
Then there's that other one where they...
What's the Duncan Jones one that was so...
Oh, Mute.
Mute.
Mute was really bad.
That one where it's the... Was but it like, Forrest Whitaker and that other guy, and it's, the world is collapsing?
I think that's called The End of the Road or something like that. Yes.
There's one with Robert Redford, Jason Segel, and Rooney Mara that came out that I actually thought was quite decent.
And that was okay.
I liked
Strange Love.
Yeah.
And the other Redford one?
Not The Old Man
Our
Soul, the Gun.
No, Our Souls at Night.
Our Souls at Night, yeah.
Nice.
That's Netflix as
well? Yeah.
How are these? The only movie that I've recognized from what you guys have all brought up is Cam.
I was just going to say that. I honestly think it shows what...
They promote their shows more than they promote their movies.
You don't know what's on it. And that's one of the things is, like, you actually have to read certain columns that, like, Jason Bailey does a lot of stuff where he does deep dives to see what movies are good on Netflix. And
their documentaries are fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
But I guess it might even just be each person's individual analytics, because I watch a lot of docs. Mm. So they're just showing me more docs, and then I'll watch a post-apocalyptic thing, and then they'll show me all these shitty post-apocalyptic things.
Their algorithms, they don't work, I think. I don't think they want them to work. They just want to show you what content they
paid for. I want more Vanessa Hudgens as twin princesses.
Hey, y'all, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking about Karin Kusama's Destroyer. You're listening to Who Shot Ya?
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Maybe this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I am your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are...
April Wolf.
Graham Elwood.
Alonzo Duralde.
Today we are talking about Destroyer. Alonzo, we are back to you.
Yes,
if you could please give us a quick synopsis
of
this
spoilers.
Film.
Okay.
No spoilers.
All right, no spoilers. Nicole Kidman is a very boozy LAPD detective named Aaron Bell. And she happens upon a murder scene while super hungover and sees a clue and then gets another clue in the mail and realizes that somebody that she thought she'd taken care of years ago is back. And she's trying to find her way back to him via an old network of accomplices, which in turn takes us back through her own tortured past from when she was a fairly young cop on the force, and how an undercover operation went terribly wrong, leading her into the turning her into the shell of a human being she is today.
Boom. How's that? That was great. Roll credits. That was Destroyer, y'all.
Good night.
I feel like the narrative that is happening online with this movie and in interviews that I've seen is what Nicole Kidman, the physical transformation that she goes through in the role in this movie. Physical transformation meaning just the makeup work that is done on her, what she looks like in this movie. People are saying this is kind of like, you know, when an actor wants to get an Oscar, they really, like, ugly themselves up.
This feels like someone sat down and went, how do we get an Oscar?
Is that what it felt like? Is that what it felt like to you?
It felt like that to me. That was, I wanted to like this. I really like Nicole Kidman. I like a gritty cop drama. I like an unresolved case and the jagged edge, and then we got to go back into the case files and this one that haunts me.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, it just felt like this is such a – this. It just felt like, okay, ugly yourself up. And be gritty and try to get that Oscar. It felt like she watched the movie Narco and went, I want to do that.
Hmm.
And it's hard for me when a massive, beautiful A-lister, it's hard to get past them. Like you're watching a movie the whole time going, well, that's Brad Pitt or that's, you know, George Clooney or these, and she's on that level. And so it was hard for me to like, accept it.
Yeah, no, I was saying April may disagree with me on this, but I think this is one of those rare areas in which this is where gender isn't an issue. I think if you are a tremendously attractive movie star, be it a female movie star or male movie star, and you want to be taken seriously as an actor,
mm-hmm.
that, yeah, at some point or other, you have to do this, like, I woke up in a cement mixer thing, you know, and like, just grab yourself down and unshiny yourself as much as possible. And, you know, I think Jared Leto has built an entire career out of this, you know, sure. that like,
he literally puts, like, shine on him sometimes, though. Like, it just greases himself up.
I mean, like, he was a teen idol for a hot second in my so-called life, and basically has been as Johnny Depp as possible, as far as, like, nope, gonna, like, make myself look crazy because I don't want to be pretty. I'm a serious thespian, you know? Mm. And that can work in varying degrees, and I think you can point to some performances that are real standouts that are really great, and other times where the artifice just kind of keeps getting in the way. And I have to admit, this one, I never stopped looking at Nicole Kidman looking a fright, you know, and there wasn't a moment where, like, nope, it's the character now and I'm not thinking about her anymore. I was always thinking about Nicole Kidman because I'm thinking about what she had to do in the chair every day to look like that.
And she's
film.
Like, you know, Rabbit Hole and Boy Interrupted. She's so...
Erased.
Boy Erased. She's so great. She's a fantastic actress. Yeah. So I really wanted to, like, see her do this, but... I had a hard time buying it after a while, and I don't know, I've watched a lot of cop shows and cop documentaries, and I know some cops. So then there's just stuff where I'm like, they would never cop, would never, you know. I was just like,
sure.
And so it was hard for me to just go to not be constantly going, there's Nicole Kidman in a wig, Hollywooding her way through a cop script.
When you watch a movie like, and I haven't seen this movie, when a movie like Vice comes out and, like, Christian Bale is, like, all this makeup, it doesn't seem like we're all talking about how ugly Christian Bale looks, even though he's a beautiful man.
Is
it that Vice is a better movie? Well, no, I haven't seen Vice, so I don't know.
I think it's when you're playing. It's one thing to mold yourself to, like for example, Nicole Kidman in The Hours is, you know, she's wearing the nose, but it's so that she can look like Virginia Woolf. And you know, yes, like Christian Bale put on weight for Vice so that he could look like Dick Cheney. Hmm. So it's one thing to sort of inhabit a character that we know,
a
like
real person.
A real person.
Sure.
And then another one to just be like, nope, let's just throw more dirt on me, please.
Well, because, you know? I mean, I think we had that conversation with Christian Bale in The Machinist, you know,
right.
He lost all that weight and he was like, had machine grease fucking all over his body or something. And, you know, the large part of that conversation had to do with how ugly he kind of made himself, how gaunt he made himself. So I do concede that there is some kind of...
Fat Christian Bale's totally hot.
That's so cute. You're so on brand.
American
it's
Hustle.
Christian
Bale? Less so, but yeah, Dick Cheney,
you're
Christian
okay
Bale.
With that.
Yeah,
just not as Dick Cheney. You're just right. Like, oh
just
God, do I really want
policy.
To dance with the devil? I don't know. I felt like her wig and Nicole Kidman's wig and makeup in this were too distracting, and I think that was the weakest spot. And I think that if I watched it without that, that she actually gives a very good performance, a very good physical performance. Because her body language is very interesting, and she, to me, I think was inhabiting this character in very interesting ways. But I couldn't get past that fucking wig in the bed. Because honestly, like, straight up, she is a beautiful woman in the flashbacks that we see, mm-hmm. and then there's no way. There's zero way
that that woman becomes this woman.
Exactly. Like, they're two different women, and it doesn't. And it, there's just not a, like, you don't suddenly forget what hair looks good on you. that is a thing that women do not forget. Like, we're just like, you find the hair that looks good on you, and you don't just like, oh, whatever. Because it's like the hair in the later one, it's still styled. And it's just like, so she had to get up in the morning and style that hair, this character. So, like, you don't just look in the mirror and forget what looked good on you. But also, I wanted to bring up something about the review. Like, I hope that we can talk about other Los Angeles hard-nosed detectives, too.
Yes.
Like, because obviously this is a woman. And she navigates the world in a very different manner. And the thing that I did appreciate about this movie is that because she is a woman partially and because she's an alcoholic, she gets zero respect. Like, she's like a hard ass, but like people are just like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
For real, like the idea that like she just keeps moving through the world and no one respects her and she's just like, fine. And yeah. That's...
But like Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, say, could never have pulled off that thing of where she pretends to be the concerned lady who needs legal help for her illegal, for her undocumented, you know, housekeeper or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, she's definitely milking that, like, I'm just a poor helpless lady, help me out thing, which is, and I mean, like, you know, the Chinatown character, other detectives will fake other stuff to get the information they wanted to manipulate people to helping them. But that specific brand was like, ah, yes, as a woman, as a, you know, as a white lady, you know, you can get away with that.
Like, there's a specific choice made to make her humorless and to make this grim. And I tried to look at it in terms of like how we view other Los Angeles detectives, whether it's Elliot Gould in
Long Goodbye.
Long Goodbye, or whether it's Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, or whether, you know, like, how do we view these Los Angeles detectives? And oftentimes they're very smart, you know, Big Sleep.
Russell Crowe in L.A. Confidential.
Yeah. It's just, you know, they've got like a one-liner they can bring out or something. And in this way, this female character is different because it's almost like it's saying, like, no, if this character existed, like, they're not going to get by with a joke. It's going to be fucking terrible.
That's an interesting point, because I hadn't looked at it that way, because part of me initially when I saw this movie was like, well, I can't say I'm sort of an expert on cops, but I know some cops. I'm friends with some of them, and I know some female cops. And the way the female cops carry them, I mean, the cops all carry themselves in a very similar manner, especially detectives. Like, detectives, when they come on the scene, they call the shots, and they're very dismissive of, like, uniform officers a lot of times and stuff like that. And, like, the female cops that I've met, because they take more shit, have zero patience for anyone's bullshit, and they got no problem just going, fuck you, because they have to do that all day, every day. And that was the one thing I was like, it was interesting to show a cop in a different way, like you say, not getting away with, because she can't just like, hey, cute charm.
People are like, oh, fuck that. Oh, no.
Yeah. When as soon as she shows up,
it's God. I was like, fuck.
You know you smell her before you see her. Right?
But that was the part where that was kind of interesting. But then I just went, how the fuck is she still on the floor? Like, someone would have ran her off. Like, they would have said, you're done. Like, I don't know. I just had a hard time,
There were moments in this movie where I was like, oh, what an interesting sort of subversion of, like, cop movie, cop show cliches. And then other times I was like, oh, cop movie cliches.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I kept falling in between that same thing.
Like that scene with Bradley Whitford, for instance. You know, you are set up to expect certain things that then don't happen and then do happen, but maybe not quite in the way that you would have seen them play out.
I like those scenes with Bradley Whitford.
No,
those
are some of the best scenes. Part of the movie.
I thought those were great.
Those were ones I was like, that's where I kind of felt like, oh, this movie actually has some ideas and it's sort of subverting, you know, this notion of what we're expecting. And then other times where it's like, literally the first time she says, Silas is back. I was like, oh, it just felt such a, like, oh, we're firmly in cliche town.
Yeah, the writing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Serious problem.
One thing that I kind of wanted to get into for a second is Nicole Kidman is one of those actresses who I think very much does the one for me, one for them kind of thing.
Yep.
Like, Aquaman is a one for them, and this is a one for me. And often I find that I think she's got a lot of great one for me's, you know, Birth and The Hours and a lot of those films that are the reason that we think of her as being such a great actress. And I wish that she had better luck with her one for them's, because I think a lot of them probably on paper seemed like, oh, well, this will be great and people will love it. But like, then you get like Bewitched or The Stepford Wives or something, and it's like, maybe not. But Aquaman, obviously, you know, huge hit for her. So that's very canny for her, because now whatever crazy algorithms that they use for, like, you know, how much are we going to pay you to be in our movie? She now has this $1 billion movie on her resume. You know,
she has one of the biggest franchises. Yeah, behind her now. Absolutely.
I mean, she plays the mom in Lion. She's amazing in that. I mean, she does these like supporting roles sometimes and these really well written.
Yeah, like I have issues with Boy Erased, but she's terrific in it. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
I I should say Birth is one of my favorite movies, and that was the one for her. Julie Kirkwood is the cinematographer on this film, and she is one of my favorite new cinematographers working in indie film right now. She also shot Oz Perkins' I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and that is one of my favorite Netflix movies. It's actually made by Netflix, and it is fucking good. So I'm glad I could bring that full circle to our next conversation.
Do you think she does? Did she shoot L.A. in a way that you found exciting?
She shot L.A. in a way that I felt was different, at least different. I thought that it was like kind of just how L.A. looks when it's summer. You know, like it's not always beautiful is the thing. Like
Sometimes it's stark.
It's stark and it's just like I want to be inside with the curtains drawn because
the sun is beating down
too much. Yeah. And I felt like I don't want to ruin anything, but I felt like the last shot, the way that they kind of planned the cinematography and lighting of that, to me, it felt like Julie Kirkwood kind of leveling up a little bit. So even if the whole thing wasn't a success, it's like it was nice for me to see her kind of getting out and doing something different. And I think that whatever she does next is going to be wonderful. But her cinematography and I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House is just like, it's beautiful and it's just inside a fucking house that was built on a set. And it's just like to make something look beautiful in that manner is very difficult. So she's got a really beautiful eye, I think.
I think she did a really good job of depicting. This is why I kept wanting to like this movie more, of showing the ugly parts of L.A., the underside. I mean, I've been in some of these bad neighborhoods and it's like it's not the Grove. It's not the Third Street Promenade. I've seen, you know, like South Central and all this stuff. And it's like it's gnarly, man. There's a whole other side of L.A. that a lot of people don't see.
It's the east side.
It was never on Baywatch.
It's downtown.
A lot of it is the east side. It's Echo Park. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, it's South Central. I loved that. When we get to like what the heist is, the heist that goes wrong, it turns out it was a heist that wasn't even in LA. It's out in Palm Springs. Out in this bank. Like, just what a great way to show, you know, when we're used to seeing, you know, things go wrong in To Live and Die in LA, things go wrong in Heat, things go wrong in these LA movies that we're so used to just seeing, you know, whether it's set it off, yo, you know, like mm-hmm. I really did. I don't know if I've lived here long enough to say I appreciate it, because sometimes when I see LA in movies, I'm just like, oh, cool. But then there are times when I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't live that far from there. Like Tangerine, like, oh, yeah, I live up the street from there.
Yeah, I used to go to that donut shop on my lunch hour, which was like, oh, it's Tangerine. I used to be there.
That Hamburger Mary's at the end is literally around the corner from my house.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I live Tangerine adjacent.
Well, let's go around and tell the people what we thought about this movie, whether they should screen it, whether they should stream it, or whether they should skip it. April, I'll start with you.
I would say stream it. I don't know. Screen it is whatever. But I think that there's some interesting things enough to consider, you know, its addition to the canon of L.A. detective things to check it out. So stream it.
Word. Alonso?
I guess stream it. I'm a kind of mezzo on it, but there are some moments that really land, and yeah, I think it is a movie that you spend wishing it were a little better, and maybe thinking of figuring out the better movie that it could have been, and hoping it's going to go in that direction. It doesn't always do it, but it does at least offer that level of promise. And Kidman is, even if the externals are distracting, she is still like acting the shit out of it.
Why? Yeah, I'm in the streaming camp too. It's like, you know, it's not the first season of True Detective. You want it to be that. And it isn't, but there are, again, there's moments in it, the cinematography.
Well, at least it's not the second season.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Dude,
it's right in there. It's like you want it. It's like you want it to be the first season. Because, again, the Matthew McConaughey's makeup doesn't hit you over the head when he's aged and more haggard, you know. They didn't do it too over the top. He's a beautiful guy that they just made look older and haggard and too many beer and cigarettes. And her, they did too. Yeah, it's between season one and season two of True Detective.
I'm so glad you said it, because like one of the things I wrote when as soon as the movie was over was like, this would have been a great season two of True Detective. It's multiple timelines. It's a cop trying to right a wrong from the past.
And you could have spent more time, because they introduce stuff that you're like, well, what? Wait, whoa.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What happened to this, where you could have spent a whole episode on that
right.
thing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Also, Toby Kebbell's flashback wig, the worst.
That's really bad. I thought that, like, it's he was one of my, for the leader of the crew, I wanted another actor
in
that
role. Oh,
boy,
he was like a boy band.
Yeah, it and just didn't, that did not work for me. Yeah,
well, they built him up as a
Silas.
Exactly.
Well, we get it. Like, that's it?
That's
really?
It? He made
the guy from the Hurricane Heist?
All he did was make one guy play Russian roulette?
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, I would say as well, stream this movie. I enjoyed the shit out of Nicole Kidman's performance. I liked how fucking raw and nasty and grimy she looked. This is one of those movies where I want to watch it again like 5 years from now. And see where we're at with it, you know?
Yep.
Because every time
we should with all of Karin Kusama's movies.
That's what
because
I was about
it
say.
Turns out sometimes we're fucking wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So like I haven't seen all her movies, but a thing that happened, a conversation that happens a lot when I talk about her with my friends is, oh, yeah, now I like that movie. When I first saw it, I was like, I wasn't sure about it. So I don't know if this is one that is going to, like, age well. I just don't know if it's going to age well. I'm looking forward to seeing it again after I... One of my robberies goes wrong when I'm working undercover.
There you go.
Feel me? You feel me? Ward, we are going to take a break. We're going to take a break, y'all, from Space Ghost. And when we come back, we are going to talk about movies that we have changed our minds on. You are listening to Who Shot Ya?
Hey, it's Jesse, the host of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I'm coming to Portland, Oregon. We're going to be doing a very special live episode of Bullseye, my NPR interview show. It's taking place Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall. What are you going to see if you go to Portland, Oregon to see this show? You will see me live on stage talking with folks like Corin Tucker from Slater Kinney, director Lance Bangs, writer Bill Oakley, Simpsons legend. We will also have live music from Roseblood and live comedy from Katie Wen. It's going to be a blast and a half. It's also part of a big podcast festival called Listen Up Portland. Tons of other great podcasts are playing at it, too. Our pals the Doughboys, among others. So, again, that's Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon, 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale now. Get them at listenupportland.com. And thanks.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I am your host, Ricky Carmona. Joining me in the studio today are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Graham Elwood.
April Wolf.
We have a segment right now that we are calling Film Flops. It must be out, I think, just in the universe, because I was on our Facebook page, and somebody asked a question that is very similar in the vein as to what we're going to talk about here. They wanted to know, what's a widely panned movie that you like? And the movie that they were using as their kind of like reference point is Mystery Men. They're huge fans of Mystery Men, and they still...
There's a cult for that, but yeah, I'm sure the reviews were mostly terrible.
Probably. I remember the reviews for that being very negative. What we want to talk about today, though, is movies that either we loved when they first came out and now we hate, or movies that we hate right now. But when we first came out, we were completely on board with them. And it could be because they have just not aged well due to whether themes in the movie that just don't fly anymore, whether it's because we are older now and we've just learned to look at the world a different way. Really, it's just kind of however, you know, personally it relates to you. So, Alonzo, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, it's funny. We were talking about this. I don't have a movie that I hated and now love, because usually if I hate a movie, I don't revisit it. Mm. Like, if it's a fun, bad movie, that's one thing. But, like, if it's a movie that I'm like, it doesn't, I don't like it, then I'm not gonna, I don't have time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A movie that I discovered in the last couple of years that I used to love, that I now realize is terrible.
awesome.
Is 1986's Absolute Beginners. It's a British musical.
I'm out.
It was, at the time, I think, like, the most expensive film ever produced in the UK, and it kind of, like, bankrupted Goldcrest Films, I believe. It's directed by Julian Temple, who did Earth Girls Are Easy and The Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Julian Temple did Earth Girls Are Easy?
He did.
Wow. Did he do Boxing Helena as well? Is that a
Julian Temple? No. That's David Lynch's daughter.
Yeah.
Wow. I canceled that then.
Anyway, so Absolute Beginners was this big, elaborate movie about London in the 1950s, the sort of teenage explosion post-World War II. And I think I had read a lot about the movie leading up to it and had seen the stills. Has a great soundtrack. Like, I still heartily endorse the soundtrack. It's got David Bowie and the Style Council and Slim Guyard and, you know, the Specials and all these amazing people. And then the movie at the time, you know, I remember, like, I was living in Nashville that summer, and I drove to Atlanta to see it, and I saw it several times in the first year of release. It was just like a movie that I really kind of held in my heart because it's like colorful and splashy, and it's got really cool like 50s fashions and cars and all these things, and you know, it's just this thing that I really treasured. And then a couple years ago, I guess it was when Bowie died, LACMA did a retrospective of some of his films, and they were showing Absolute Beginners. I was like, oh, wow, I want to go see this at the Bing on the big screen there. And it's a turd.
Yeah.
Like, for all this movie has, like, so many ideas that are just jammed together with no connective tissue that makes them work. And there are these, like, moments that kind of pop. Like, they built this whole sort of dollhouse set, you know, where, like, it's like you're seeing an entire house, but the front wall is missing. Mm-hmm. For this big elaborate musical number for a song sung by Ray Davies. You know, you have Anita Morris, who is this amazing Broadway performer, and she was in Ruthless People, the red-haired, you know, lady, who's this great sort of screen siren, kind of playing around with her sort of sex symbolness, you know. There are just things here and there that work, but as a whole, it is just like no one was running the ship. And, you know, it ends with this, like, race riot mm-hmm. that just doesn't...
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, but it's a musical still, so, you know, a lot of dancing in this race riot, and it's just...
Nothing says musical like race.
Well, you know, look, they're remaking West Side Story, people. So anyway, it's a hot mess by the soundtrack, but you can skip the movie.
Graham, do you have something now?
You know, I have. I mean, obviously, I could go into the vault of a bunch of movies I saw when I was a kid that don't hold up. Meatballs, you know, stuff like that. That's just like, wow, that doesn't hold up. But when we were sitting here thinking before talking about it, I'm reminded of the first time I saw the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks.
Mm.
I saw it on a massive screen in Westwood, and I was like, ugh. And I was so bored with the, like, talking to the ball, and I'm like, what the fuck, come on. And then they kept playing it on cable and HBO or whatever, and I was like, this is amazing. I was like, Tom Hanks is so intriguing, and I think it might have been, I remember back in the theater, someone was talking, and they, you know, someone was like, well, what's he doing? Why are you saying? You know, and I was like, oh, fucking
outside distractions.
Idiots, watch the movie. Typically, it gets explained. Yeah. That's why you don't have to see it. And I started watching that movie, and now I think that movie is amazing that he is able to act alone with a ball. Mm-hmm. And what he goes through, I mean, Tom Hanks, the actor, whatever, lost some crazy amount of weight. They stopped production for 7 weeks or something like that to go shoot another movie. The director shot that other movie with Harrison Ford.
What Lies Beneath.
What Lies Beneath, yes.
And I was like, and...
So if you ever see this on a plane, it'll be like the greatest thing you ever saw.
Yeah. And I think what Tom Hanks goes through, and I love, there's so many little details of it now because I've seen the movie so many times. Like when the FedEx package is washed to the shore, it's not like, hey, flares and a radio. Like, he, you know, he has to make do with like ice skates and a dress and like a ball. And he has to figure this thing out. And then the speech at the, yes, the spoiler alert, the speech, you know, when he gets back and the drama of Helen Hunt. She thinks he's dead, so she marries another man. She didn't do anything wrong. She didn't cheat on him. The guy that married her, nobody did anything wrong. They thought he was dead. And she's so, that scene where he comes back and she's so conflicted and gets in his car and then they kiss and then she stops and is like, ah, you know, it's like, this is hard for everybody. And then he goes to his buddy's house and he tells that story of like, I was going to kill myself and I tried to hang myself and the rope wasn't thing. And then this thing washed in from Bakersfield, this toilet, you know, this portable toilet that he makes into his sail. And he goes, and it's such a, I don't know. I just like the lesson of the life. He gets to the end of the thing and he's at the split in the road.
Yeah.
The woman whose artwork on the pat, you know, like, it's just like, I don't know. I just, it's big Hollywood, like, he doesn't get back with Helen Hunt. he has to discover his own thing. And I don't know, there was no bad guys in it. Everyone was good and just in a really difficult situation. And now I love it. And I think it's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
The first
yeah.
time I saw it, I was like,
it's a movie that ages very well because yeah. it's like, that was the first thing that Zemeckis and him did after Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
And I think people were, I feel like the reviews were okay, but yeah. everybody was awed by Tom Hanks' performance. And I think now when we watch that movie, I've seen that movie recently, yeah. And now it's just kind of like, oh, this is, I mean, I'm not going to say like a masterpiece, but it is, it ages very well.
Yeah.
It ages very well. It's no longer, I mean, you watch it kind of like fully taking in the whole story.
When they cut back to 4 years later after he's been on the, and Tom Hanks from an acting perspective is playing like, oh, he's a little crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He's
mm.
been talking to himself for 4 years.
I love that shot of like where they have the big party for him at the hotel.
Yeah.
And then everybody leaves and he just sees all this like leftover food on the table, or he's
the crab
been like,
legs.
Yes, where he's been like scrounging for fish, you know, and I was like, just gonna throw it out, you know, it's no big deal.
And then he sleeps on the floor
because
his bed's too soft.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I love all those little things.
Yeah, no, that's a great one. That's a great one. April, what do you what are you okay with now, or what do you like? You'll get that shit out of my face, take it to St. Elsewhere.
I mean, any Chevy Chase movie. Okay.
In which direction?
where
Funny Farm? You're not Funny feeling Farm? Funny
Come
Farm
on.
Anymore?
Funny
Come
Farm doesn't
now.
Hold up.
Come on now.
I used to love Funny Farm when I was a kid.
I
loved
the
it.
Last
we had the
act
VHS.
Of Funny Farm.
I used to love it, and then I
the
watched
great George Roy Hill.
Oh my God! It's
yes,
one of those things where, like,
shout out to George Roy Hill.
Like my love of anything that was Chevy Chase is just like that's gone. Whereas my love for like the Money Pit is grown.
Nice, Shelley
yes.
Long.
Honestly, yes. anything with Shelley Long was just like nope. Appreciate her. Like when I rewatch Cheers because I do that a lot, I'm just like nope. She's the best part of this fucking show.
Outrageous Fortune does not get the the love it deserves.
I forgot. About outrageous
I love
Fortune.
Outrageous wow. Fortune.
I mean, like Neil LaBute. I used to be really into Neil LaBute shit.
Mm,
and then,
yes.
like, the older that I get, the more I'm just like, nope, fuck him. And
is it that he's not commenting on it? He's just doing it?
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's just like The Shape of Things I used to just love because I was just like Rachel Weisz, Gretchen Mol, fucking Paul Rudd, you know, and I was just like so into, because I started off as a playwright. And so I was, you know, I used to worship him. And then, you know, it's just, I just ended up just not liking him. I just didn't, I don't know. I don't connect with it in a way that I thought I wanted to connect with it when I was young. So, yeah.
Neil, when you said Neil LaBute, the first thing I thought of was like, oh, how we look. How people looked at a movie like Fight Club back in the day and how they like trying to watch a movie like Fight Club now and just the issues of like what it means to be like a man.
Yeah.
I've seen – what's the movie? I saw Nurse Betty.
Sure,
that's a Neil LaBute movie I've seen.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really have kind of like the same like masculine vibe to it that something like In the Company of Men does.
Yeah.
It's like you watch that movie and it's like, what am I supposed to be getting out of this movie? I don't know if I'm at the right age yet to be getting the quote unquote right message out of this movie.
Whereas I still, I'm sorry, the other playwright, Glengarry Glenn Ross.
David Mamet.
David Mamet. Like, I still love Glengarry Glenn Ross because it's just
so
like,
yes.
it's like, it's so far over the top of masculinity that you're like, this is all bad. This is very clearly like,
he's become a loon, but his old stuff is still good.
Stuff,
like, Homicide is still great.
Yeah, yeah.
Homicide? No, I was about to say, is that streaming? Homicide is on my list of movies that
oh,
I check on
Ricky,
to see if it's
you would
streaming.
Love
I know.
Homicide.
Many people have told me this.
There was a Criterion of it for a hot minute. I don't know if there still is.
Red Belt, that's another Mammoth.
Red Belt is another one.
That's Mammoth gone loony, I think.
Oh, is that right?
I think he's right on the... He's not completely up the river like Colonel Kurtz. I think he's still... When Kurtz went to Airborne when he was in his 30s, I think that's where Red Belt is.
Oh, yeah, Oliver Stone stuff I started hating when I got older.
Yeah,
I was just like, oh, nope.
Yeah, it's so Oliver
Stone-y.
When you watch his stuff now, you're like, he's just so like, I'm a director. I'm directing every scene.
The shit out of it. Yeah, he is. Yeah, like I love JFK, but that becomes a harder watch.
I'm getting less forgiving of Judd Apatow as the years go by.
Like, oh, is that right?
I used to really love his stuff and was okay with the fact that they were all way too long. But I think now I feel like I've seen so many movies where it's like, let's improvise the shit out of this and we'll figure it out in post, that I've now kind of gone a full 180. Like, no, give me a tightly scripted comedy, please. Mm. And not just this thing that, you know, you're just going to run the camera and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, those are so ad-libbed that they have to light for 360 because they're shooting the whole thing.
Everything. Yeah.
Everything.
All the time.
The ones we started off the show talking about a Coming to America sequel, and one of the first movies I thought about where I'm like, I'm not as crazy about this anymore, because I watched it with my girlfriend recently, because she had never seen Beverly Hills Cop 2 before. And I was like, you ain't never seen Beverly Hills Cop 2? Here we go.
Is that Brigitte Nielsen
one? That is the Brigitte Nielsen one.
And I never liked Cop 1. Because you know what? That movie is, and again, this is the Eddie Murphy conversation we always have, fucking homophobic,
it's very
that
homophobic,
movie.
The whole movie? There are scenes in that movie that do not age well.
Yes, okay, fine.
Every
single scene isn't homophobic, but Herpes Simplex 12 lives forever.
It's the gay couple walking down the street and he laughs at them when they're in the matching outfits. That's pretty homophobic.
The whole Queenie thing of, like, you know, trying to get into the restaurant. The Bronson Pinchot character, who only Bronson Pinchot's innate dignity elevates it from what the movie wants it to be.
That character's homophobic?
It wants to be, but I agree. Yeah. I think Bronson Pinchot is like better than the character, and so there's a level of humanity to him in a weird way.
But then there's funny stuff in there, like, we're not going to fall for the banana, the tailpipe.
Course,
yo, brother, you got to say it. Like, That's funny.
I've always thought that when he turns on and laughs at that couple, it's because they're wearing matching Michael Jackson outfits, and he's like, fucking Beverly Hills, Los Angeles, look at these
weirdos. That could be that.
There's a lot going on in that scene, but that one of those things is faggots, so, you know. Which I'm sure there were probably takes where Eddie Murphy turned the camera and said, faggots.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Oh, brother. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Cop 2, not holding up?
No, I feel terrible just bringing up the goddamn movie.
Sorry.
No. Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 2, it is a very obvious symptom of, like, 80s, early 90s sequelitis, where it's like, hey, let's make another one of these. And it's just Eddie, like, who it literally looks like he just, like, walked out of his trailer and was like, are we rolling? Here we go. Here's the money shots I'm giving you. Here's the one-liners I'm giving you. And then he just goes back in his trailer and waits for Tony Scott to call him back out again.
That's like they did that with Robin Williams. Like, just let him, just roll.
Just let him go. Yeah,
just
exactly.
Let him go. Yeah. No, you need a script.
Yeah,
you need a foundation.
Absolutely. Hey, yo, before we go, we are going to give out our staff picks right quick. Every week we got a movie that we think y'all should check out. It doesn't have to be in the theater. It can be streaming, what have you. April, what do you have for the people this week?
Well, it's one that I actually caught on TCM. The other day.
Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah. And it's great because you recognize the style, like, turn it on like a quarter of the way through, and my husband and I are watching it, and it's like, it's called Out of the Past, and it's Robert Mitchum and Kirk Douglas, and it is really beautiful film, and it's a noirish kind of
It's noir.
I know it is. Yeah, it's noir. Robert Mitchum plays this like a gas station owner who has a past, and the past comes to find him, and he owes a debt because he didn't finish a job and, you know, screwed over this guy. And I really like it, but it's Jacques Turner. It's his movie, and he did Cat People in 1952, and this is about 5 years later, 1957, I think.
I think
58.
42 and 47.
Oh, sorry, 42 and 47, yeah. So it's about, you know, around 5 years after that. So it's got the beautiful cinematography of Cat People. Mm. You know, you guys know Cat People. It's one of my favorites. I love looking up stills of that. It's so beautiful. I really enjoyed it because I just fucking love Robert Mitchum.
He's so great.
Anything that he's in is just, it's just better for him having been in it.
And so. Jane Greer is one of the great, like, noir femme fatales.
Yeah.
Ever.
This is one of her bigger roles, too. Yeah. And then Jane, she was also in, like, later on, wasn't she?
She was in Against All Odds, which is a remake of Out of the Past.
Yes,
actually.
Yes, yes, yes.
Jeff Bridges movie.
Yeah. So Out of the Past.
All right, that's what's up. Alonzo, what do you got?
So you probably heard there are two competing Fire Festival documentaries on Hulu and Netflix. And as
it's
of
beef.
This,
is Hulu and Netflix
exactly,
beef?
Exactly, yeah. It's, you'd think it was movies about volcanoes or Truman Capote or something.
No, Fire Festival is so hotly contested.
Yeah, it's everyone is all over it. Now, so as of this recording, I have not seen the Netflix one yet. It premieres on Friday. But I have seen Fire Fraud on Hulu, and it's really entertaining.
Okay.
I mean, it is like a really slickly produced, lengthy news segment. You know, I mean, it's. I think there are people I've already sort of heard sort of sniffing about. Oh, documentary. You know, because it was sort of rushed out to kind of get there first before Netflix's. But it's really informative. It's quite funny. It captures the whole sort of Schadenfreude of the whole Firefest thing, where all these like social media dipshits went down to, you know, the Bahamas only to discover like they were going to stay in FEMA tents and all the bands canceled
with Ja Rule.
With Ja Rule, exactly. But it actually
social media dipshits.
But they talk to the scam guy who put this whole thing together, which the other documentary doesn't do. And it turns out the other documentary is actually produced by the people who did the social media for Fyre Festival. So each documentary is throwing shade on the other one. Like the Netflix one is accusing the Hulu one of paying the organizer for being in the movie, and Hulu's accusing the Netflix guys of letting the people who were co-conspirators of making the damn movie. Anyway, I hear they're both good. I want to see the Netflix one. But Fire Fraud on Hulu, check it out.
All right. Boy. Graham, what do you got?
Well, first I'll just say, see Roma on the big screen.
My man.
I just got to say that.
Well, sure.
The
sound mix on it and everything. It deserves to be on the big screen.
Yes.
But then I just watched, streamed it. I saw it in the theater when it came out, Hell or High Water, which I really liked. You know, Taylor Sheridan wrote the script, and there's so much more to it than just like a heist. It's really talking about the decimation of the housing crisis and people losing and this, you know, like there's so many little things in there. Like the opening scene, they pan across and there's this like graffiti that's like three tours in Iraq, but there's no parade for me. They're robbing these banks, and there's just a lot of like, you know, their mom got hustled into one of those reverse mortgages, which is a scam. All the predatory lending, they all talk a lot about that and how these small towns have no jobs and no nothing, and that's sort of the tapestry of this. And then it's really good acting. I mean, Ben Foster plays a great wingnut. You know, and
yeah.
Chris Pine has done, you want to talk about One for Me, One for Them. He's really good at like, you know, he could just be pretty boy movies, but he's doing this other stuff. And then Jeff Bridges, even though he's all mumbly and but I'm all for it. And I forget the actor's name, who's also in Wind River, that plays his partner. It's just really, it's.
And Katie Mixon is the waitress.
Yes.
That waitress scene is amazing.
Yeah.
Hell or High Water is great.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
So
that's one that I would put in film plops. When I first saw that movie, I was okay with it. And then I saw it again a second time and I was like, oh, this is fucking great.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was I thinking?
The social commentary about like what happened from the recession and all that stuff is like
That made more sense to me as far as like, yeah, like how people lost their homes than a movie like The Big Short did.
Yeah.
The Big Short was throwing so much information at me, I was like, just tell me who's bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Hell or High Water, I was like, oh, it did not work out for these people at all.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
these people are not shown in movies.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. It's a ground level of like the recession and globalization and how it affects like people in West Texas. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. It's really great. And that's streaming on Netflix right
now.
It's
on Netflix.
Yes? Yep. It's on Netflix right now. So check that out, y'all. I have been on a boxing movie / documentary kick since I watched Girl Fight last week, which was my stat pick. And ESPN does these 30 for 30s. I've recommended some of them before. Their newest one is called 42 to 1, which is about those were the odds between Buster Douglas.
Oh, that's a great
Mike
doc.
Tyson. It's great. It is fantastic. It's a really great just look at this. I mean, the career of Buster Douglas and then just the craziness that was that night in boxing.
The stuff about his dad.
Amazing.
Like, I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got emotional watching it just because I grew up watching boxing with my dad. It's a great story of an underdog. I mean, it's, yes, like back in the day, we all wanted Tyson to win and we thought Tyson was the best, but you were kind of like Is anybody going to beat this guy? And fucking James Buster Douglas.
Well, the context of, like, Tyson was unbeatable.
Unbeatable.
He was no one had ever seen a fighter like this ever.
Yeah.
Ever. And then who's this guy? And I mean, Tyson was just clocking guys in the first round, like one after another after, in the first 10, you know, 5 minutes, two
yeah.
minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, that's a great story.
Yeah. Tyson is the reason my parents stopped getting pay-per-views. They were yeah. like, we are not spending $75 to watch 2 minutes of something. Mm-hmm. That is not happening anymore. And this doc is so great. It's, I can't recommend it enough. It's streaming on ESPN.com right now. So check that out. Yo, shout out to everybody who leaves us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you leave us a 5-star review, we will read that mug on the show. I'm going to start off with my man, Billy Hunt. They say, I love this podcast. The hosts offer a range of voices about films and introduce me to new movies I need to watch. Keep up the good work. Keep up listening to us, Billy. Thank you,
Billy. KCC Swegman says, wanted you to know your podcast got me through the holidays, and because of you, I was absolutely that obnoxious girl saying, oh, that came up on my podcast the other day, and I am not ashamed. I'm out here spreading the good word about the hilarious, brilliant, and yet totally accessible Who Shot Ya, and wish more conversations about film and basically anything else could be as honest and lovingly brutal as you all are with each other and your guests. Thank you. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you, Casey.
Then we got Micah23. This is the best film podcast of all time. Ooh, Micah.
Well.
Oh, shit.
We were just saying that.
Do I need to keep going with this review? Every week, Ricky, Alonzo, April, and Drea give their academic and cultured take on new films. I followed Alonzo over from the tragically canceled What the Flick, RIP. Now every week I look forward to hearing their reviews. Also, Man of Steel is a great film that only suffers from a disturbing third act flight sequence, and Ben Affleck should make that accountant sequel,
yes,
The Accountant's Returns. And where the hell is Paddington 3, damn it?
See that? Our listeners bring the real talk, yo. Our listeners bring the real talk. Shout out to Man of Steel. Shout out to Man of Steel. Where's Paddington 3 at? You feel me? Graham, thank you so much for being
here,
dude.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you all.
So
thank
great. You.
His podcast is Comedy Film Nerds. Where else? Where they can hear that?
Yeah,
on
go
iTunes?
To Comedy Film Nerds. It's yes. on iTunes. We're at Comedy Film Nerds on Twitter, Facebook, and all that stuff. It's a really cool weekly podcast with my co-host Chris Mancini. We have guests on, and it's we've done over 500 episodes.
Oh, that's wow. what's up.
We made a documentary, Earbuds, the podcasting documentary that we produced and I directed, and it's a really cool. It's a check it out, and then just go. My tour dates and everything are at GrahamElwood.com.
Hell yeah. That's what's up, y'all. Thank you so much for being
Thanks.
Here. April, Alonzo, thank you all for being here.
Kind sir.
Next week, we will all be back here, minus Graham. We will be back here next week to talk about Glass. Our special guest next week will be a writer from Late Night with James Corden. Jared Logan will be with us in studio. That's going to be a super fun episode. Hey, if you have any comments or suggestions, questions about this week's episode, questions about the story, like I said before, you can call us on the Who Shot Line, WSY-803-1664. That is 979-803-1664. You can send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. You can tweet us at whoshotyapod. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org, and that's what's up, yo.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.